Welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Well, on his Middle East tour, the U.S. president talked big and bold. Is there now the Trump doctrine? Also, we are to believe there is a growing U.S.-Israeli rift. If so, then why does the genocide continue? To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And here in Moscow, we cross to Mark Sloboda. He's an international relations and security analyst. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's start out with Mark here. Before we start what could be called the Trump doctrine, it's a lot of rhetoric. We don't have a lot of evidence of facts still. But give us a summation of what happened in Istanbul and what's next.
Okay, so I guess the most important story is Russia's diplomatic victory. And this is actually the way it's being reported in New York Times, too. Russia has long insisted that they wanted negotiations with the Kiev regime on settling this conflict diplomatically, addressing the core issues that led them to the intervention in the Ukrainian civil conflict in the first place in 2022, but that it was the Kiev regime that walked away from the Istanbul talks in 2020. Well, they're back in Istanbul. In fact, Russia apparently even requested the same palace and the same room. Their negotiation team is headed by the same person. They are openly signaling and saying this is a continuation of Istanbul, Istanbul plus, if you want to use that, because obviously there's new facts on the ground and new facts in the attrition, deterioration of both the Kiev regime's forces and their NATO stockpiles that have been funding for them for this war. Russia insisted that there had to be talks and that there would be no ceasefire, except that evolved out of those talks at some point eventually in the process, potentially. Meanwhile, the Kiev regime and the Europeans were saying no talks without ceasefire. Well, they lost because there were talks. Nice. And evidently, this was explicitly on Trump's screaming capital letter orders on social media. There was also then a little bit of maneuver and games about whether who would be participating. The Europeans tried to create a grandstanding act for Zelensky, insisting that Putin should come. Putin didn't come. He sent a professional team of experts, some of which had been involved previously, some of which were an upgrade to begin serious negotiations, not a dog and pony show for Zelensky to trot out in front of the media. And eventually he was forced to just ignore his own diktat that there would be no Ukrainian officials negotiating with Russia and send a negotiation team as well. They didn't agree on much, a POW exchange. They will explicitly lay out each other's demands for a ceasefire, but they are going to meet again. Again, this is apparently due to Trump's pressure, and Russia has given Trump credit for that.
Okay, well, George, that's the germane thing moving forward. They have agreed to continue talks, though not much was done. What's the role of Donald Trump in all of this? Because he likes all the attention focused on him. He wants to be the power broker here. Has that calculus changed at all, George?
No, I think, as Mark pointed out, it was Trump's pressure that secured this meeting in Istanbul, because the plan, as we were discussing last weekend, was that the Europeans would do this grandstand tour of Kiev, demand absolutely unconditionally that Russia must accept this 30-day ceasefire. And then when Russia said, no, we're not going to accept it, then Trump would join the Europeans and say, well, that's it. I've had enough sanctions on Russia. That didn't happen. Putin made this proposal to meet in Istanbul to continue with these negotiations. And then the crucial event was Trump's intervention that says, yes, absolutely, these negotiations need to take place. So Trump announced on his Truth Social in all caps that he intends to speak on the phone to Putin on Monday. After his conversation with Putin, he will speak with Zelensky, and after that, he will speak with NATO. Now, I tend to think that there's a good chance that he will arrange a meeting with Putin, because he, you talked about it several times during the past week, that nothing is going to happen until Putin and I meet. And I think that's probably true.
Okay,
I
mean, okay, all right, all right. We're there. Okay, Mark, why meet? To accomplish what?
This is Trump's, I would say, his puerile little obsession. His idea of how high-stakes geopolitical diplomacy is the art of the deal. Where with a handshake and a smile and maybe a little bit of leg-breaking threat in a smoke-filled back room that everything could be settled. If I can just meet Putin, we can make a deal. We can arrange it. Putin will agree to everything I demand. The Russians have been very cagey about this. Saying, yes, Trump and Putin will meet eventually at the end of a process with proper preparations where they have something to sign that was worked out by, experts doing the hard work of diplomacy. Well, the Trump people are pushing real hard right now. The Kremlin does not want to be put on the spot in front of cameras where Trump demands a ceasefire, the Kellogg 30-day unconditional ceasefire, and Putin says, they don't want to be put on the spot like that, although I think eventually it is going to be inevitable. And then once again, we're back to the question. When Russia continues the conflict and will not end it on terms that are acceptable to the U.S. and will not accept a ceasefire, what does Trump do then? We still don't know. The narcissist in chief will be placed in a quandary.
Well, George, I mean, it's already been mentioned here, but how can it be different from the original round of negotiations that we had in 22? I mean, essentially, they're building on the same thing, and the outcome will inevitably be that? Is this what there's going to be settled upon? Which, of course, all what the Europeans are doing now will be memory hold and all of this. Again, can Trump, where the Boris Johnson as the surrogate, he ended that process. Can Trump, as a surrogate, reignite that process and get essentially the same outcome?
Well, I think Trump can reignite it. I think it was significant that during the past week, the Americans floated this new proposal of reviving the NATO-Russia Council. And as Peter, as you and I discussed, NATO-Russia Council, of course, that's an absurdity. It's been in abeyance.
It's poisonous. It's quite poisonous.
However, the very fact that the Trump people are thinking in terms of creating some sort of a framework to discuss European-Russian security issues, that indicates that we've moved beyond the talking points during the Minsk process, where somehow it's all to do Russia and Ukraine and so on, essentially ignoring what Minsk was supposed to do. By talking about some kind of a European security process, a revival of Helsinki, ideally, that would indicate that the United States is thinking about how can we have a permanent settlement in Europe so that this kind of thing doesn't keep happening. And that means the issue that the Russians wanted addressed and now have to address for many, many years will be on the table, which is NATO expansion, NATO moving up to Russia's borders, NATO moving its forces close to Russia, its missiles and everything else. That's going to be on the table. And Trump could well be on the way to actually dealing with that issue. And after all, I mean, we can say, the meeting between Trump and Putin comes to the end of a process. But this whole thing, we know, is a war, essentially, between Russia and the United States. So it makes sense for there to be.
But George, what you described, I think, if my memory serves correctly, was what the Russians were proposing in December of 2021. It's remarkable. It's almost a duplicate. Mark, what Trump wants, he wants his cake and eat it too. He wants this thing to end. He's genuinely not interested in it, okay? But he wants to have better relations with Russia. Can he have his cake and eat it too?
No, he can't. He can't. He can. He cannot at all. It's not going to happen. He's going to end up Brandon 2.0 and forced by the impetus of American institutions and Europe into sanctions and more weapons supplies, even if they're arranged as a, you know, a business agreement instead of gifts. And I think that's a very optimistic take on bringing up the NATO-Russia council, which Russia clearly doesn't have any interest in. I don't see it in such highfalutin terms indicating U.S. interest in a pan-European security architecture. I see it more as an attempt to toss a bone, a sop at Russia, much like bringing the G8 again, these irrelevant formats. You know what? If you just give up your demands in Ukraine, we'll let you sit at the cool kids table again with us at the G8 and the NATO-Russia Council. So we cool, okay? That is, Russia barely, you know, bothered to dignify that, you know, with a response and a quick dismissal and back to, well, back to the battlefield, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, George, doesn't Trump really risk a loss here by pushing so hard to have a one-to-one meeting? I mean, because there's not enough substance there. I mean, that could be humiliating for all concerned. I just don't see the Russians walking into a situation where they don't have some form of leverage, George.
Well, I think if there is some kind of a willingness on Trump's part to concede on Russia's key points, and he's already said we're ready to concede on territorial gains for Russia. Now the question then is, what's the extent of it? So they already conceded everything that's already under Russian control of Russia. But then there is the additional. Trump said in that interview with Bret Baier that everyone has been poring over, he's already said Russia will get a chunk of Ukraine. I mean, that's already a done deal. Then the question, well, if you've already accepted that Russia will get a chunk of Ukraine, well, how big is this chunk going to be? So we've moved the ball quite a long way. And so, you know, so there is something to discuss. I mean, if you've already conceded on that and you're willing to discuss these other issues, there's something to discuss in the
meeting. Well, I mean, Mark, why should Russia be happy to be given something that it already has?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the point. And within evidently these negotiations, Russia's demanded as the most basic precondition to any ceasefire that the Kiev regime has to withdraw all the troops that they have left in Donetsk, Lugansk, Kherson, and Zaporozhye. And the Ukrainian says, that's unrealistic. That's not going to happen. Russia said, well, fine. According to the Ukrainians said that the Russians said, that's fine. The next time we talk, it will be five oblasts that you have to withdraw.
All right. On that point, gentlemen, I have to jump in here. We're going to go to a quick break. And after that quick break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. To remind you, we're discussing some real news. All right, Mark, I want to go back to you. Let's change gears here. Trump had a very interesting trip through the Middle East. There's so many different ways you could describe it. I mean, one headline was Trump rejects interventionism, regime change. We had language like the so-called nation builders wrecked far more nations than they built, and the interventionists were intervening in complex societies that they did not even understand themselves. Those no American president has ever said anything like that. Okay, particularly when we look at the post Cold War and post 9/11. Amazing words. What do they mean? Do they mean anything?
I don't think they mean anything. The U.S. has long since given up on nation building after the failures of Iraq and Afghanistan already by, I would say, 2010. If we see from U.S. had regime change efforts in Syria and Libya, They simply avoided the messy nation building afterwards. This has already been largely accepted in U.S. military and policy papers and think tanks and the like. They will, you know, support Islamists and jihadists, you know, wherever to achieve their geopolitical goals. They just won't try to refashion the country afterwards. They'll leave it a squabbling mess. If there's any real Trump doctrine that came out of Trump's trip to the Middle East, which amounted to, as far as I see it, Trump taking center stage on a stripper pole while various Arab leaders threw money at him as he undressed himself. It's that The Guardian defined it as pay for access or pay for play. I see it more as imperial tribute, right? The Arab leaders have learned that if you provide him with the adulation, the flattery, the pomp, and throwing money at him, then they're guaranteed good relations with Trump for at least the next, you know, if not 4 years, then at least two or three out of it. And that's what we saw. $600 billion from the Saudis, $1.4 trillion from the Emiratis, $1.6
and an airplane
from the Qataris, and a luxury 747 thrown in to seal the deal. This was familiar territory for Trump. He knows he's going to be treated like the God Emperor of mankind by the Arab leaders from his first weird trip there. And this is, you know, him getting the adulation that he feels he deserves without any critique, which is why he didn't stop by on Israel on the way over there.
Well, so speaking of Israel here, I mean, George, you know, these words, anti-interventionist, anti-regime change, you know, those are, you know, he could be his people. Whoever wrote that is watching this program. But an important thing he didn't mention was Palestine. What's going on in Gaza? And that is the key to so many different things. I mean, what was it, you know, before Israel, the United States had no enemies in the Middle East. And then, you know, after the advent of Israel, it had enemies. It had it found itself in a quagmire over the protection of that small settler colonial state. So, I mean, without going into that area, that what does his words mean?
Well, to be honest, I mean, it's a 77-year relationship. I mean, that isn't going to change overnight. I think it's significant that he didn't say anything at all about Israel one way or another. When the subject of the Abraham Accords came up, he said, well, we'd like you to join the Abraham Accords, he said, to Saudi Arabia. But I guess, you know, you'll make your decision in your own time. We're not going to press you on it. What Trump is doing, I think if we could talk about this Trump doctrine, which is, I think, certainly he's abandoning the rules-based order, that all that talk about. He's abandoning a foreign policy based on values. He's abandoning any notion of a league of democracies. He's abandoning any attempt that somehow America is in the business of promoting values. He's abandoning any idea that somehow America has permanent friends, and we have these sentimental attachment to friends. He said, hey, these people in the Arab world, they're talking our language. They're talking the language of business. They're about investment. They're about jobs. They're about improving the lives of, you know, their own people and our people. Our people are going to do well out of it. Whether that happens or not is different. Look at who aren't our friends. Well, the Europeans, because the Europeans are screwing us over and they want to get us involved in their stupid wars. He says this. They want to get us involved in their wars. We don't want to get involved in their wars. And we're getting screwed over by their economic arrangements. Well, you know, we're losing out on it. Who isn't a friend? Israel is a net beneficiary. We give them money. We money goes out of the United States into Israel. The Arab world, money is going from there into the United States. So in Trump's mind, well, these are the people we should be doing business with. And that's why I think it's very significant that if you abandon all of this nonsense of sentimental attachment, Israel is the greatest democracy, Israel is our great ally, Israel is our one friend in the Middle East, then we are moving into a new era and we can't speak about something called the Trump Doctrine.
Well, you know, Mark, also what was important during that trip and up until this moment is his whole approach towards Iran, which he used very, very harsh language in audiences. I mean, there were, you know, number one, everything about nation building and regime change. Everybody in those rooms already knew that. He was sending this to his base or, you know, to Washington. It wasn't news to anyone in the room. But when it comes to Iran, there was a lot of bluster, but maybe a ray of hope too, Mark.
Yeah, I have to agree with George a bit. I think the Trump trip signified that he has absolutely no values whatsoever, no interest in values. He posed with the new terrorist leader, the new terrorist ruler of Syria, who is committing a genocide of Alawites and Christians in Syria as they met, as we speak, al-Julani, right? A man whom, at least until Trump embraced him and said he was a handsome and tough guy, was literally
tough history.
$10 million the State Department wanted for information that led to his capture. Well, maybe Trump will collect that money. I don't know. But then he had comments afterwards. He says, well, he's a tough guy. Yeah, I mean, he beheaded people literally himself. He was the leader of both ISIS and Al-Qaeda in Syria. And Trump said, well, you know, I mean, no journalist actually said that to him. He simply said that, well, you don't put a choir boy in that position. No, you put a terrorist, right? And he said that he did this on behalf of the Arab leaders, MBS in particular, who were throwing all that money at him. So, what that says about a peace process in Iran, I don't think it actually says anything good. He just put Al-Qaeda and ISIS in charge of Syria and withdrew the sanctions from them now.
Ahmed al-Sharaa, Julani, I mean, ISIS and Al-Qaeda, they've been essentially de facto allies of the United States for many, many years. This goes back to the Osama bin Laden era in Afghanistan. It went on. It was in Yugoslavia. It was throughout the Middle East. This wasn't an invention of Trump. So therefore, for him to embrace Ahmed al-Sharaa, it's nothing unusual. Yeah, the United States has been using these people for years and years. But also by this time, you know, it's spilt milk. I mean, he's in Damascus. Everybody else has stepped in to recognize him. And he's done the same thing. If he hadn't lifted the sanctions on Syria, then we'd all be sitting here and denouncing Trump for, oh, Trump is still imposing sanctions on Syria. Syrians are suffering. It's over now. I mean, the time to have prevented him from coming to power was last November and December. That didn't happen. Now he is in charge. But the policy of supporting ISIS and Al-Qaeda, that long predates Trump, and it's been a long, cynical, brutal policy on the part of the United States.
Okay, Mark, I started with Iran. I want to go back there because it's very, very important. It looks like there's some kind of understanding going on. One of the problems we all have is listening to so many contradictory voices coming out of the Trump administration. That's turning into a norm. But it looks like it's just the issue of Iran acquiring a nuclear weapon, which we all know it's not working towards it. At this point, it's not interested in having. If Iran is bomb, then it certainly will become a nuclear power without a doubt. So, I mean, is Trump's approach going to end with some kind of eventual agreement that he actually walked away from in his first term?
Yeah, I think we're eventually going to see a JCPOA 2.0 rebranded for Trump. Oh, better than the original gold lame tacky covering or something like that. I think that the Trump regime is already backing away from its demands, absurd demands of a couple weeks ago that Iran give up its civilian nuclear power program, its entirety, that it stop all of its support for Shiite groups throughout the Middle East because the U.S. is allowed to have proxies, but not anyone else. I think they're slowly walking away from that. There was a painful realization, I think, in the Trump administration this week when they walked away from Yemen, when they walked away and declared victory when in reality it was the U.S. in effect capitulating. The New York Times admitted in its pages that the U.S., the most powerful military air force supposedly on the planet, failed to achieve air superiority over Yemen, the poorest country on the planet. If they can't achieve air superiority over Yemen, and they're wasted too many air defense and long-range strike missiles there, how could they think of doing that against Iran? I think there was a splash of wake up realism towards the Trump administration's policy to the Middle East, and it's the lack of U.S. military capabilities to force their will on the region.
George, real quickly before we end here, do you believe that Trump will fight Israel's wars at least during his time in office?
I don't think so at all. I think he's realized that Israel is just a real problem for him. As I said earlier, it's a net beneficiary of American largesse. America doesn't get anything out of it. In his mind, what are we getting out of Israel? And I agree with Mark. I think Iran, Trump is realizing that this is an absolute disaster waiting to happen for him. If he starts bombing Iran, I mean, probably he's going to lose American aircraft. And Iran's going to walk away from
and maybe MAGA and MAGA
and MAGA. Iran walks away from the non-proliferation treaty, and therefore it's the worst possible outcome. And so therefore it'll ensure a failed presidency. So he's not going to do it. I think there will be a JCPOA 2.0.
All right, gentlemen, absolutely fascinating discussion. We're going to find out if Putin and Trump will meet, but that will be for another time. I want to thank my guests in Budapest, here in Moscow, and of course I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.